when you're in there and you're stripped of all your comforts and with a group of strangers 24/7 in this extreme environment, you have a mirror held up to your face and it's ugly. I saw things that I really, really loathed about myself. All of these things, you're sort of faced with your weaknesses, your insecurities, and everyone else is faced with the same thing.
Welcome to Two Women Chatting. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Liz.
In our sort of daily lives, Liz, do you think, well, I mean, it has been a bit, do you think? No, don't think. Don't you think this last couple of years has been a roller coaster of challenges?
I think that's an understatement. For me, it has. Well, it's not challenges. That's not the word. Opportunities, I'd like to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we recorded an interview that's coming up with Janie McGill, who is an adventurer.
Yes, and it's slightly different to us.
She kind of puts us to shame because she is, well, gosh, the list of things that she has tried over the years and achieved is really quite remarkable. And I'm not sure that, I mean, I have done some fun things, more when I was in my 20s. We did do hill tribe trekking in Chiang Mai and Chiang Rai in Thailand. Mm. And that was pretty hairy stuff because James got really sick. Have I ever told you this?
No.
Oh, my gosh, he was so sick. We took off and it was supposed to be six in a group. Ended up that four other people did not join us. So it was us two and a guide. And
when you say took off, not literally.
No, we took off on our hike.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And we were both, you know, you've got to carry everything you need for the next 2 or 3 days. Well, day one, don't know what he'd eaten, but he was sick as a dog. Sick as a dog. And this is so frightening. So at the time, I wouldn't say I was completely vegetarian, but because there were so few of us, we got invited to the tribal chief's hut in the evening, and we were sitting there and they were preparing the food, and it was all the women, you know, culturally it was all the women sitting in a circle by the fire, and they were preparing this thing that looked really rather red. And I said, oh, you know, what's, I said to the guy, what is that? And he said, that's pork in blood. I'm like, you got anything else? Got a cheese and pickle sandwich. We realised that was it. That was all we were going to be offered. So we decided that we were going to ask the chief's son if we could give him some money and go and get us some Mekong whiskey. Because I thought the only way I'm going to get through this terrifying jungle experience, because I'm scared to death of spiders. And when we had gone into where we were supposed to sleep, it was like kind of like a barn on a shelf. I'm not kidding. It was just cobwebs everywhere. It was like my absolute worst nightmare. And we were sitting out in the dark and a praying mantis fell on my shoulder. So by this time I was like, give me the worst whiskey in the world and I'm just gonna
down it.
And sure enough, James was so ill during the night I had to take him to the hole in the floor in the middle of the village. I kid you not, it was lit by moonlight. There was nobody around.
How romantic.
No, it was awful. It was awful. I was scared of snakes. I was scared of everything. And so he went to this like little shack or whatever, and he was in there. I stood outside. Bloody elephant walked past. I'm not even kidding.
Walked past?
Yeah. Honestly. So I feel like I've had an adventure and I don't need to have another one in my life unless it involves a poolside bar and a 5-star hotel.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you there.
But that's me. But anyway, Janie is done. Far more exciting things than
not
that.
Not exciting. Well, yes, it is, but different.
Different.
Your trip, that's a... I wouldn't want to have done what you did.
No, it was quite sort of fashionable, I think, back in, what was that, the late 80s, early 90s, to do that last century.
It's so old, isn't it? Well, it is last century, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, Janie's done something a bit more recent, and do take a listen, because she is extraordinary, the way that she has forged forward, and she's got quite the tale to tell. So it's great to have Janie McGill join us. She is a woman of many talents and incredibly courageous to boot. In her 40-odd years, she's been a lawyer, soldier, art dealer, life model, estate agent, amateur jockey, groom, dog carer, presenter, web designer, speaker, film consultant, photographer, and she's an adventurer. Arrowhead is the title of Janie's film that follows her expedition across the Empty Quarter. That's the world's largest sand desert in the southern third of the Arabian Peninsula, with two Omani women. With a male British and Omani crew in support, they are the first modern women to walk the Empty Quarter, which is 758 kilometres across. That's the equivalent distance of London to Switzerland, over 28 days, and with a clear objective: to challenge prejudices, to break down stereotypes, and to deliver a message to the world that we are better together, regardless of culture, gender, or identity differences. And you have fascinated me since I first came across you and your expedition. So welcome to the podcast, Janie. It's good to have you.
Thank you very much, Michelle and Liz. That was kind of, it's funny when you hear all that stuff back because, you know, we're just muddling along at the end of the day, aren't we?
Exactly. And it's been a while now, hasn't it, since you've done that expedition. But we just wanted to... Okay, number one, why?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Why? Yeah.
Oh, but do you know what? It was probably a lifetime of experiences which led me to it. But the actual catalyst, I think, was I was dating this major in the SAS, and he had served in Saudi Arabia and did lots of training in the Empty Quarter. I'd never heard of this place before, but on our first date, he showed me this little ancient arrowhead, and I was totally mesmerised and overexcited by it. And I wanted my own one. I knew that I wanted to go to this mysterious, romantic place and find my own arrowhead. And that's really, I think, where the seed began.
Oh my God, you got me too. That is such a cool beginning to any story. I love it. Yeah. Did you find an arrowhead when you went?
Well, I did find an arrowhead. It wasn't an arrowhead in particular, but sort of metaphorically, I did. But I found this little rock which had Arabic writing in it. It was in the middle of a wadi, in the middle of nowhere, and just drawn to this little rock which had an inscription of some sort, but it was Arabic backwards. So it was really odd. I never got to the bottom of it, but I do still have it.
It was like you were meant to find it or something.
Yeah, I mean, just in this thousands of acres of wasteland, and I was drawn to that. It was bizarre.
That's so cool.
That's the archaeologist in me coming out. I'm really interested in that.
Oh, is it?
I saw archaeology.
I'll have to show you it later.
Yeah, and the arrowheads. Oh, that's it. That's another story completely.
Did you ever get out to that kind of neck of the woods?
No, I got to, as you know, to Wales and to Jersey
or somewhere,
to Hadrian's Wall. That's why I gave up studying archaeology. Well, I studied it, but never became an archaeologist. No.
You could still become an adventurer. No age is banned from that. But so, looking at, I've watched the little YouTube clip, and I can't wait to see when this is, you know, the bigger picture, literally, of all your video diaries and the stunning drone photography and everything. But if I can take you back to the beginning, so now we know why you chose the Empty Quarter. How did you pick the two Omani women, and why did they want to do it?
There was no specific method of finding them. It happened very organically through people that I met. I had been to Oman on a couple of recces in the lead up to the expedition, and there were just a few people. I don't know. I think we were just drawn together. It was kind of one of those things that was meant to be. You know, I found two women who were equally as disillusioned, perhaps, with the world and where we fit in it or what we do. And it was they had a huge amount of enthusiasm and a need to do it as much as I needed to do it.
And they were complete amateurs, weren't they? Because even in that short clip, one of them is wearing flip-flops, and as she's walking, you know, she's got like some blisters and so on, and she's like, oh, it's much better in flip-flops, actually. I think I'll just carry on like this. Yeah. I love that sort of very
natural,
very like approachable, you know. It isn't all about, obviously, you've got to have good equipment and you've got to have an incredible backup team, because it is one of the world's most hostile areas, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think us girls, I was certainly just under the impression, you know, if I've got water, I've got food, we've got fuel, we've got comms with a sat phone and microphones, walkie-talkies between the teams, I didn't see, you know, if something goes wrong, we just deal with it. But with that in place, I didn't feel a huge amount of concern, really. I don't know, but I'm quite sort of, I suppose, not risk averse. What the opposite of risk averse? I do like taking risks. I enjoy that. It's exciting.
Maybe
a bit gung ho, and I think certainly that may have caused some friction amongst the team. You know, because not all of us were gung ho, so there was sort of, you know, some bits of why isn't this planned? And I'm like,
so how long did it take to plan the expedition, though? Was it, you know, weeks, months?
I had started conversations with production companies in Channel 4 back in 2014, I think. And then I had a bit of a meltdown with splitting up with a boyfriend, a bit of an identity crisis. So I moved to France to look after this blind dog for 18 months. And then I really picked it back up when I was in France. So I was pushing a lot more. And that's when I managed to get Land Rover to sponsor as well. A lot of this was also just through my network, you know, and contacts and having been put out. I was doing a lot of walking before anyhow. So people were aware that I was on this kind of mission, I guess, of discovery or rediscovery of, because I, you know, totally lost my way.
What, before you did this expedition, you felt like you had lost your way? So what led to that then?
Well, I was on my career path in the army, in the military. I was training to be a lawyer, and I joined the reserves as I was training. And then my other big sort of passion and identity was horses and horse riding. So I married the two and was going to ride in the Royal Artillery Gold Cup. It's a military horse race. And I broke my back when I was training. And so that essentially drew a line under the biggest parts of me, if you like. So almost a large part of me died, really. And I had to re-find what it was, what I was without that, and who I wanted to be.
So with such a sort of a life-changing injury, if you like, did that mean you couldn't continue working in the army, in the Royal Artillery?
Yeah, it put a stop on doing the course that I would have needed to do to become a lawyer within the army. I had been on a leave of absence for, I think, 18 months, and then administratively I was discharged, and then I tried to rejoin the Navy and the Army afterwards, but they wouldn't have me.
That's awful, isn't it? I can see why you started to feel like, so you had this very specific career journey. How lucky that you'd got your love of horses and your being a lawyer and being part of the Army, and then it all implodes. So you completely adrift.
I didn't realise that until a couple of years later, to be honest. The wheels really started to come off, and I went a bit AWOL. And I just went back to basics. I went down and lived with a friend of mine in Devon, in his old farm in the middle of nowhere, and I sort of went pot washing in pubs and things like that. And I really did just go back to absolute basics to just experiment and find out what it was that really kind of, you know,
what drove you,
struck me, and
yeah
because sort of normal jobs, there was not, it's not, I've really struggled with that.
It's clear you've got an adventurous spirit, and you know, I can see why that wasn't gonna last. Let's take you back to the desert then, and your journey there. So how did it start? It's 43 degrees, isn't it? 43 degrees centigrade, roughly, of every day. It's just sand everywhere you look. The roads have stopped. I mean, in that video that I saw, even the expedition team, you've got to carry all your own fuel, haven't you? Because you can't just stop and refill up at the nearest oasis.
We had to be sustainable for 2 weeks. So, and that was part of the desert where it's enormous flat plains, 6 kilometres wide, with the huge dunes that we imagine. yeah, imagine of a desert. But with that, you couldn't easily get in and out to anywhere to refuel or resupply. So, yeah, we had 2 weeks where we were just... But, of course, with that comes huge amounts of risk as well for the drivers and the support team, because they're driving over, they're having to navigate over these dunes with enormously laden vehicles. So the flip risk is high. I'd say it's probably the risk for them was higher than for us walking.
And I think it's probably fair to say that it wasn't all sunny, happy journey, was it, with you and Althea and, oh gosh, I wrote her name down.
Bader
and Althea. Yeah, so it wasn't all happy days, was it, between the three of you? You go on each other's nerves, but some of you may have wanted to go a little faster than others from A to B, you know, to hit that target. Because I'm assuming that if you don't hit that target, you could end up in quite a pickle in the middle of the desert if you don't get to a certain place by a certain time.
Yes, I think it was more behind the scenes what was going on. I mean, you have to understand with these edits, it's edited in a very specific way, isn't it? And so there was a lot of emotional turmoil going on in our personal lives. And I think that's probably what drew us to the desert, to have that space to, you know, understand what's going on. And my dad was in the very latter stages of cancer. And so I really needed to get home because I didn't know if I would see him again. So I was, I was pushing hard. And there were other influences as well, you know. I mean, you really, when you're in there and you're stripped of all your comforts and you're essentially with a group of strangers 24/7 in this very extreme environment, you have a mirror held up to your face and it's ugly. Like, I saw things that I really, really loathed about myself. So all of these things, you're sort of faced with yourself, your weaknesses, your insecurities, and everyone else is faced with the same thing. And I think we found that those insecurities were really sort of bouncing off of one another. And it's only on reflection, I think, that we can see that. But we all still chat now.
Do you? I was going to ask that. Yeah, are you still friendly? Because you've been through an incredibly bonding experience, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, it really was, for me, like, probably one of the most fundamental things in my life and a turning point for me and how I feel about myself. And a lot of the film is, on my side of the story, is with the relationship with my father. And that all plays into the patriarchy and the stereotypes and the prejudices, which essentially us as a group of girls really turned that round. I'm from the patriarchal family, and Bader and Althea are actually from matriarchal families. You know, Bader's mother was a single mum, you know, but 30 years ago, when that was kind of unheard of in the Middle East. So, and likewise, Athea's mum, a very, very successful businesswoman. So, you know, what we perceive and what we're told here in the West, it wasn't quite how it was. I mean, certainly, of course, it still is, but maybe these are the exceptions that break the rule.
And do you think you were able to break down those cultural differences and sort of just get to the essence of the three of you are just women facing an enormous challenge, and you're all the same, really? You've all got same burdens, emotions, worries, concerns. So you break it down to the essence of what you are.
That's exactly it, Michelle. It didn't matter where we came from at the end of the day. We were there, we were doing a thing for our personal selves, for our, as a community, in a community spirit as well. And we're all subject to insecurities and, you know, and the strengths and weaknesses and emotions. We're the same.
Do you think they took away as much as you at the end of it and felt that they could go back into their cultural identity and be different, be the same, or, you know, deal with things in a different way? How do you think it changed them?
I think it was definitely a pivot moment for all of us. Sometimes it's even more frustrating to have to go back after you've done something like that, to go back into society again. It's sort of, it's hard because you've been through this hugely transformative experience, but nobody else has changed.
Yeah, you're going back into the cage in a way, aren't you? You're just being bound again by cultural norms that you want to shake off potentially. And you've seen a different way of living, but you can't necessarily follow through.
Exactly. So I think it can go one way or the other. I think it's a bit like being a soldier on tour, you know, when someone comes back from Afghanistan, they have had just this immense experience. And to then just go back and, you know, fit into normal life again is very challenging. Mm. Very challenging. So I say don't.
Don't fit in. Don't fit in.
No, don't fit in.
What would you say you learned most about yourself and about the other women in your 2 weeks, 3 weeks you were there?
I think it's about perceptions and perspective. You know, a lot of people think that you need to be the fittest person or be a specific type of person to do something like this, when actually you don't. I think it's a lot to do with your heart and what's important to you. And if something is important to you, you just do it. You just get on and do it. And, you know, Michelle, Liz, it may not have been a priority for you to walk a desert, but if it had, you would do it.
It doesn't have to be, I would say, something as big. That's an enormous expedition, what you've done. I mean, it could be something as simple as setting yourself a challenge, like, I'm going to get fit enough to walk the Seven Sisters pathway. Mm. Or I'm going to try and, what was that mountain?
Ben Nevis Scarfell. Or Scarfell's Pike.
Yeah,
that's what I want to do, yeah.
I think setting personal goals is just a brilliant, I mean, it can be small. It can be able to touch the floor again, you know, through Pilates.
Because we all think we can't do it, but you've proved it. Yeah. It's made me think it really has.
Well, you're going to do your outdoor swimming, aren't you?
I still do.
I've seen that happen.
Well, no, outdoors, outdoor swimming pool in the summer. But I'm going to do But it's true, we can do it. There's no excuse, but we always seem to find excuses.
Oh, chilly.
And you've proved that you can do it.
It literally.
That's it.
Yeah. Mm. But what doesn't kill you does make you stronger. And I think women in particular, we take on so many burdens throughout our lives, emotional and physical, that we are incredibly strong. We hold up a lot of people. We multitask. But it's very easy to fall into normal or boring or just feel like you can't do it. And I, you know, Liz and I are big proponents of reinvention of yourself at whatever age it might be. And, you know, we're in our 50s and I love setting new challenges for myself, even doing a podcast. That's a bit of a scary challenge that we took on, because I've talked to you, haven't I, and said how basically we know nothing, still pretty much know nothing. We have learned a lot, and we have gone on that journey. It's not quite walking the empty quarter, I will say that, but actually going back to that, this is the way my brain works. Paul, I don't know how she deals with me half the time. I'm like, oh yeah, squirrel. Anyway, talking of squirrels.
No, I'm the same.
Did you see any scary? This is so banal. Did you see any scary stuff in the desert, like spiders and snakes?
There were lots of spiders, little ones, and we only saw one scorpion, and we got you have this sort of UV light almost, and it picks them up. But because of we had the light, that was attracting the moths. So the moths and the scorpion were like having
all you can eat buffet.
Do. Yeah. And I saw a sort of praying mantis kind of thing about this big. And there was only one night where I slept in a tent. And that was because at this particular camp that we set up, there were snake tracks.
So where did you sleep? If you weren't in a tent usually, where did you normally sleep? The 5-star Hilton up the road. Sorry, I was just joking.
On the rug by the fire.
That's Bear Grylls.
Yeah, well, it wasn't like an emptied out camel or something. A carcass of a camel. That's Bear Grylls, isn't it?
No, God, no. No,
but wasn't it quite chilly?
I kept it simple.
Was it colder? Yeah.
But it was. Yeah, it was. I think the hottest we had was about 45. I can't think, maybe the average was probably about 38, but it would really smack you round the face at 10 o'clock and at 2 o'clock. Like, you would literally feel like you were getting doof by the heat. But then, yeah, it would get chilly at night. So I had a puffer jacket and I had a mountain sleeping bag as well.
Mm. Now you do an awful lot of speaking, don't you? Yeah. And motivation. I see that you deal with imposter syndrome. Love a bit of imposter syndrome. That's us right here.
But you're still doing it.
We're still
somehow
doing it.
Somehow.
People pleasing.
That's the key. Yeah. Oh God, that was a nightmare.
What, people pleasing?
Yeah, that was a big issue on the expedition because I was trying to please everybody, and you just simply can't. You know, and that, I think that was the reason of a fair bit of conflict because I was just trying to please everyone.
Do you think that's a lot to do with our gendered identities? Do you think because we're women, we often try to please rather than, you know, we're seen as bossy if we're telling people what to do all the time, as opposed to you would expect Ralph Fiennes to be the boss of an expedition and you're right, you're going to do this, we're going to get here by 5 o'clock this afternoon. And so it's that perception, isn't it, of a woman, she takes charge, she's bossy, God, she's annoying. But if a man takes charge, it's just an alpha male doing his thing.
He's been the leader.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I tell you, there was a bit of conflict between me and the support team as well, because I think one of the support was very nervous and anxious about us and wanted us to rest at lunchtime. So I was just like, okay, fine, we'll rest at lunchtime. We didn't need to rest at lunchtime. But I was kind of keeping him happy. But then I think that stems back to my father and keeping him, you know, trying to please him and keep him happy. And just, he was quite a tempestuous character and trying to keep the status quo, you know. So I think it stems from the past for sure. But it's only until it starts playing out and you start recognizing it do you see that it's not helpful. And then, but then I think the hardest thing is to then change those behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, and isn't I think it? That's Let's maybe, face it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I think that's where the imposter syndrome creeps in as well.
So do you still feel like you've got imposter syndrome?
No, I feel very pragmatic about these things now. If I want to do something and I want to achieve something, come hell or high water, I will do that. Whether I know how to do it or not, I will find out. Like, we have the world at our fingertips now, and there is nothing that you can't find out from either your network or asking someone or Google. You know, it's the seeds are all there. It's just how much you want it at the end of the day. And I also look at other people. I look at the state of governments and the people and the choices that our leaders are making. And I draw a lot of comfort from that, because the whacking great mistakes they make, they're supposed to be in charge of a country. And yet it doesn't compare to my little mistakes, you know. So I really, I do kind of draw a lot from that for myself, for my self-confidence.
Were you able to get to a place emotionally and with the time, were you able to get back and see your father and before he died and resolve perhaps some issues that must have been troubling you for years?
I did get back. I think 3 days later, he went into a hospice and he died 3 months after that. That was like being on the expedition over again, because there was so much uncertainty. I'd never seen someone sort of degrade through cancer. So that every day was something different. And I'd never seen someone die before either. So that was all new experiences for me. And it was the same as the expedition. It was just sort of his final adventure, and still uncertainty, obviously, because we don't know if there is a next step. But really, I think every day I still learn from him. every day. I mean, I think he's a character that you could never really understand, ever. What I realised was that why he was the way he was, because that expedition taught me his frustrations, potentially with me as well, because I think I felt them with Vader and Athea. You know, sort of that potential, I know you can do more. And I think he had that with me. I know you can do more, but it just made you feel so rubbish because you weren't quite there. And so those things really filtered through. And then once I'd done that, all of a sudden it became clear and I could let it go, you know, and let the resentments and the frustrations within our relationship, I could let that go.
And you got that and opportunity.
And he's human, for God's sakes.
Yeah. Are you his only daughter?
Yeah. Only daughter. I have a big brother.
I just wondered, because it seems to me, again, about sort of how as a female you feel with somebody encouraging you, motivating you, but maybe like pushing it too much, making that challenge so difficult. As you said, you can't always achieve what somebody else really, really wants for you. You know, don't know how to express it better than that, really.
And it's whether you want rubbish.
But it's whether you want to as well, I think.
Quite. I also think, though, you know, what he told me and what he told other people were two very different things. If you speak to any of the people he knows, he was so proud of you. And I was like, was he? Was he? Are you sure? Because that's not what he told me. You know, I think that's a sort of very traditional way of, you know, he was very,
it's quite generational, so. That I think that's I'd like to feel that we're not, I don't know. I'm getting a bit worried about my kids.
I don't know. I think men are perhaps a little bit, I think men are a little bit better with their emotions now. They're allowed to be perhaps a bit more open now. Certainly, I think my son is quite open about, he's not, don't ever cry. It's not that anymore. Yeah. You know, I think we've grown a lot, haven't we, over the last 40 years or so, and allowed emotions to be, I mean, God, shared all the time over TikTok and Instagram and, you know, shared.
It wasn't quite so,
It does beg the question, doesn't it? Is how, yes, exactly. When do we, are we going so far the other way? Do we need to sort of refine an equilibrium? I'm not sure.
Well, look, what are you going to do next? Because you can't possibly just finish this and not have something else that you've got up your sleeve. I would imagine you're planning some new expedition.
Well, I've got one or two ideas, but one heads into Russia, which is probably not best at the minute. I've got fingers in pies, so like I've got business ideas that I want to pursue now. I don't feel the need to prove myself anymore physically. You know, like if something came up that really grabbed at my heart, then I'd do it. But currently, I'm very happy just living in Oxfordshire with my two little dogs and walking locally, you know, and just plugging away at the laptop on these business ideas.
Well, thank you, Janie. If our listeners want to try and find out a bit more about where you talk and what you talk about, it's on janiemcgill.com, is that right?
Correct, yes.
And what's your Instagram so they can follow you as well?
It's janie.mcgill.
Perfect. Well, yeah, Janie, thank you. It's been so lovely to talk to you. Thanks a lot. Yeah, you've inspired us.
Ah, oh, good.
Maybe not the walk that far, but yeah.
Well, I could do the Seven Sisters.
Yeah. I could do that.
Yeah, or to the next village or something, you know.
We can do that, yeah.
Actually, you know, the essence of this conversation is do something, really. You know, put one foot in front of the other. Start walking. Start small.
And look, like, look around you. I think that's the key. We're always so sort of straight, you know, we're going somewhere or we're doing this. But if you just go for a walk and look.
So would you do a challenge like that?
No.
Nope.
No, I mean, no, because it's not in me. I'm not that type of person. I think that's, you know, there's different challenges and different, you know, you could call doing a podcast a challenge, certainly is for me.
Sometimes getting up for the day is a challenge for people.
Exactly.
So, there is many levels of challenges, really.
So I think it, you know, I don't I don't think everyone should go, oh my God, I've got to go and do something like that. It's an individual challenge to themselves, or it's I think it's built in people to be so
adventurous.
Yes.
I mean,
like Penny Mallory, when we interviewed Penny Mallory, she was going to row the Atlantic. I mean, right. I wouldn't even consider.
And that's like, that is an inner need to address something that's more of an adventure than a challenge, I suppose.
Well, it's in them. I think some people are just more, I mean, it's competitive or ambitious. I think that's what it boils down to. I'm quite happily being in my garden.
Well, that's what we were talking about right at the end there, that our appreciation for quiet, for just being, for listening to the birds, to, as you really enjoy, just doing gardening is just...
But I've actually taken my gardening to a different level now. I'm a bit worried.
Oh, yeah?
I'm really getting... You know, I used to enjoy it, you know, just pottering around a bit of cut. Now I'm, like, digging my bed properly, taking every single... Every plant... Not quite yet, because it's a bit too early, but every single plant... But all each area I've now drawn out...
Well, that's like garden design.
Yeah,
though,
well, maybe that's something. I'm about to become old. I just got interested in it. I think that's a passion I didn't realise was quite so.
That's the thing, isn't it? You know, it's been a hobby for many years, but now you've got more time.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't it become something that you plan and you know,
I've got bits of paper everywhere, post-it notes.
Yeah, and you love going to garden shows and exhibitions and stuff, don't you?
Yeah, and garden centres and having my afternoon tea.
I couldn't think of anything more boring in my life.
So it makes sure. So, like, Janie loved going to walk across the desert. Couldn't think of anything worse. You couldn't really want to spend, you know, I could spend 8 hours in the garden.
Yeah, I could. But I'd be reading a book and I'd have a glass of Chardonnay that's really chilled and I'd be watching how lovely the garden was growing.
Well, that's what I used to be like. I remember watching my grandmother and I'd be sitting there, not with a glass of Chardonnay, but a cup of tea or something, and thinking, oh, why is she so doing this all the time? Now I've got there. But, you know, that's, I think we evolve, don't we? As we get older, we evolve and our interests change. I think it's good to do that. I think it's good to have things change.
I do too.
You haven't got there yet.
And maybe I never will on gardening, but there'll be something else. Yeah. I mean, you know, I still, when I haven't pulled a muscle, then I do like keeping active on any kind of racket court. And I hope that I can continue to do that for a long time. And if I can't, maybe it'll be getting in a boat.
Or
and
snooker. Or darts.
Where the heck did you get snooker?
It's a ball.
Oh, my Lord.
Because you don't have to be quite so, you know, agile.
Oh, gosh.
Or darts. Darts, good fun. Yeah.
Darts is good fun. I think I once told you that I used to spend weeks before the Epsom Derby came and I would put a dartboard up in the garden and I would practice and practice. I'm not obsessive at all, me.
No, really?
Until I knew that I could win that goldfish. And I did every
single
year.
Oh, the Epsom Derby? I thought you meant the horse race.
Yeah, the horse race, the Epsom Derby.
But they had a goldfish...
There's always a fairground that came with the Derby every year.
I don't
year.
Think everyone knows that. If you live in a certain place in the world, you might not know that.
Oh, okay.
I live Derby up the road from there, I didn't know that.
Comes with a fairground and always, back in the day, I don't know if you can even win goldfishes.
You're not allowed
anymore.
To, because I had, you know, this come in a plastic bag?
Yeah.
You'd win it and you'd bring it home and your parents are like, what?
Yeah, they'd have and to put, you'd it, put in it in a jam jar or something. Yeah, yeah, well, that's what I did every year. Yeah. And some of them lasted easily a week.
No, I managed to have Joey last 2 years.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did have one or two that lasted.
And then I was like, I don't really want it, because it went round and round with the little chain of poo hanging to
Right, and on that note, thank you to Janie for being our guest, and thank you to Liz for ending it on a trail of poop. That's all from us.
Chat soon.